I'm saying, Gavin, is that if John Hinckley Jr. had worked with the IRA, the world would have been a lot better back then.
The following podcast contains...
You cannot say filth in front of people.
Explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that asks a simple question. We only had one shot to make that big impression, and you didn't even target practice. What the hell were you thinking? I'm your host, Dave Bledsoe, and this is episode number 444, the Ron, John, and Jody edition of the show, where we talk about that time in 1981 when John Hinckley Jr. missed his shot to become a legend. Stay tuned. What the Hell Were You Thinking podcast is brought to you by Boyd's Body Armor, because somebody probably wants to shoot you for something. In this crazy country filled with guns, someone out there probably has a pretty good reason to shoot your ass. So stay protected with high-quality ballistic-resistant Kevlar from Boyd's. From levels 2 through 4, Boyd's can protect you from anything the person who wants to put a hole in your person can throw your way. From a puny 9mm all the way up to armor-piercing rounds, Boyd's can protect you against that person you really pissed off. No matter how nice you are, someone out there probably really wants to shoot you. So stay safe in Boyd's Body Armor.
This is NBC Nightly News. With John Chancellor in New York and Chief Washington Correspondent Roger Mudd.
Good evening. Here's the latest. The president is still in surgery. His condition is described as good, and the doctors are optimistic. He was able to walk into the hospital under his own power, even though a single assassin's bullet had entered his left side and penetrated his left lung. The presidential press secretary, James Brady, was shot in the head and is in extremely critical condition. The outlook is not good. Chris Wallace reports from the George Washington University Hospital.
I wasn't much of a ladies' man in my youth.
What? No, really?
Yeah, I know it's hard to imagine now because I'm so clever and funny.
No, Dave,
When I was young, I was very awkward around girls and didn't really know how to talk to them.
As opposed to...
Well, by comparison, I'm suave as hell now. I could never find the right way to express my interest in someone without coming across as all...
Sprint creepy.
And from that time I bought my crush a Christmas gift and she stared in horror, to the time I tried to impress a girl by showing her my callous fingertips from playing guitar while she stared in horror, I just never quite got the knack. So, I had to use alternate methods to attract women.
Paint her to have sex!
No! I mean, once or twice, but not as a rule. A lot of time, it was just easier to hang around with women and hope that eventually one of them would decide to fuck me. You know, this worked more than you think. One of my more successful methods was to be around when a woman was dating someone I knew, and eventually that guy would treat her like shit, and she would fuck me to get back at him.
That's despicable!
I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm saying it worked. All I did was not be a dick, not overtly hit on them, and just wait for it to happen. And it happened a lot. It wasn't love. It was grudge fucking. And it was hot. Obviously, this wasn't a way to find that one true love in your life, but it was a pretty solid way to get laid. And because I wasn't known as a player, no one ever thought I was the standby dick she kept on hand for your inevitable fuck up.
Jesus Christ, Dave.
But like anyone else, I wanted to find that one love of my life, and from time to time, I had to set out to win the heart of a young lady. Being bad at this, I frequently found myself in what was and is called the,
It's called the friend zone.
Now today, I understand how completely fucked up that was. A man is not entitled to love or sex from a woman if she feels differently about him than he feels about her. That's some incel bullshit. But in my 20s, I wasn't a good human being. I mean, I fucked my friend's girlfriends, for Christ's sake. How good of a guy could I be? And when I was in the old friend zone, I would do almost anything to get that person I liked to like me back. It was sad, pathetic, and universally futile. I did some dumb things. I admit it. But hey, at least I never tried to shoot the president to get a girl to like me. Which brings me to this week's topic. When 43 years ago, the week this episode was recorded, John Hinckley Jr. shot Ronald Reagan to get Jodie Foster to like him. before we can start with John, I guess I should talk about old you-know-who's first 100 days in office.
Go ahead, say it.
Ronald Reagan's.
He said it.
He came into office in what can only be described as an ass-whipping of Titanic proportions. It wasn't quite as bad as George McGovern, but it was close. And Ron believed that he had a mandate to act aggressively on his policies, like gutting the social safety net, slashing taxes for the wealthy, and building up the military. There was just one small problem with Ron's plans.
Democrats.
They held the lock on the House of Representatives, and the GOP only held the Senate by 4 votes, which meant they had a solid veto override to any of Reagan's agenda. The U.S. News and World Report sums up the situation, quote, "In the first few weeks after Reagan submitted the proposals, they sparked enormous controversy and powerful opposition. Many critics said the president was trying to do nothing less than destroy Roosevelt's activist government legacy from the New Deal." Pro tip, he was. "The critics also warned that Reagan was overestimating the revenue that his economic plans would generate." Again, he was. "And that this would set the stage for huge budget deficits later." It did. "Those warnings proved prescient, but at the time, frustrated Americans were ready to do things Reagan's way," unquote. The Democrats, however, wanted no part of it. Reagan took office in January. He got his cabinet filled, but hadn't had much moving to get his agenda passed in Congress. The Gipper needed something to push things forward, something big, something attention-grabbing, and on March 30th, 1981, he found something.
He got shot. He almost died.
Reagan was given a speech at the Washington Hilton to the labor union leaders of the AFL-CIO, a group of people who, ironically, probably wouldn't have shed any tears if Reagan had dropped dead of a heart attack at the lectern. Let's just say it was an icy crowd that morning. The Hilton was no stranger to presidential visits. The Secret Service was familiar with the location, and the hotel had a specific entrance and exit called the President's Walk that was well known to the public. Shortly before 2:30 p.m., Reagan was leaving the Hilton. The limo was parked outside the President's Walk, and the rope line was set up about 15 feet from those limos. That was way closer than it ought to have been. As Reagan raved to the crowd, a reporter shouted a question at him, and at that exact moment, with cameras rolling, 6 shots in rapid succession came from somewhere in the crowd. You know, I bet if old Ron was asked what his positions on gun control, he probably would have had a remarkably different opinion than he would have just, say, 1 second earlier. One bullet struck Presidential Press Secretary James Brady in the head, where that bullet exploded, because that bullet had a small explosive charge in it. Yeah, these were legal in 1981. This severely injured Brady, and while he survived many years afterwards, it was the bullet that eventually cost him his life. Another round struck a Washington, D.C. police officer. A third struck a Secret Service agent shielding the president. 2 rounds went off without injuring anyone, but the 6th and final bullet ricocheted off the armored limo and struck Reagan under his left arm and went into his chest. Reagan would almost have certainly died from a headshot if not for one of the union leaders tackling the shooter and pushing him to the ground. Ironically, organized labor had saved Ronald Reagan's life.
I wish I hadn't done that.
If you're wondering if Reagan had any gratitude for the organized labor literally saving his life, let's just say when he fired the air traffic controllers not too long after that, he demonstrated exactly how grateful he was. It didn't take long to figure out that Reagan was seriously injured, and the Secret Service took him straight to George Washington University Hospital, where Reagan underwent emergency surgery to remove the bullet and repair the damage. Reagan would spend 2 weeks in the hospital and was back in the Oval Office within a month. There's a whole lot of weird shit that went on besides the shooting. A lot of shenanigans in the White House. But this week, we're focusing not on the victim, but on the shooter, John Hinckley Jr. John Warnock Hinckley Jr. was born in Ardmore, Oklahoma, May 25th, 1955. Ardmore, Oklahoma, a town fuck all from nowhere in southern Oklahoma, which I did look up to see what it's all about today and promptly closed the tab out of boredom. The Hinckley family was big in the oil business. His father, John Sr., was the founder, chairman, chief executive, and president of Vanderbilt Energy Corporation. The family left Ardmore and moved to Dallas in 1959. Now, John Jr. would just miss being old enough to have to worry about going to Vietnam. Not that he would have had much to worry about being the son of a fucking oil baron. Upon graduating high school, he did what so many sons of rich fathers did. He half-ass attended college, in his case, at Texas Tech. Texas Tech, by the way, their little athletic slogan, guns up.
Ah, foreshadowing.
To say that John was not an enthusiastic student would be selling him short. He was a profoundly indifferent fuck-up, riding on daddy's money and pursuing his music. According to the Lubbock Centennial, Lubbock being where Texas Tech is located, quote, "The few persons in Lubbock who have known Hinckley say they're shocked. He kept to himself." They always keep to himself, says Beverly Macbeth. She attended junior and senior high school with Hinckley in Highland Park. "Most people who went to high school with him probably wouldn't remember him because he was so low-key." Macbeth says Hinckley had few close friends, if any. She remembers him as a quiet, B-average student. He was quiet and reserved. Everybody always says that about people that shoot fucking presidents. He first entered Texas Tech in 1973 as a business administration major. He later switched to arts and science major and attended Tech as late as the first summer session of 1980 without obtaining a degree, university officials say. A photograph of Hinckley in the 1974 La Ventana Tech yearbook lists no club memberships at the university, unquote. He went to Los Angeles in 1975 to play music. But really, what he did instead of playing music was write letters to his parents, asking for money, and complaining about how hard things were in Los Angeles. But hey, at least he took the time to make up an imaginary girlfriend.
Well, it does sound like something that you would do.
All of my girlfriends were real, even the inflatable ones. Now, if all this sounds like typical rich kid douchebaggery, it was, but also... At the time, the cheese was slipping off John Hinckley Jr.'s crackers. While in California, John caught the movie bug.
We got a film buff on our hands.
Well, not all films. John was more enamored of a specific director, in this case, Martin Scorsese's Au Revoir. Well, not so much as Au Revoir, but one single film, 1976's Taxi Driver.
De Niro, in Bang the Drum Slowly. The critics called him a brilliant new talent. After Mean Streets, they said he was a genius. For his performance in The Godfather Part II, they gave him the Academy Award.
Come on, man. Just get me out of here, all right?
Now, Robert De Niro creates a terrifying portrait of life on the edge of madness.
Tabby, just forget about this. It's nothing.
Taxi Driver, a film by Martin Scorsese.
And even then, Hinckley wasn't watching the film for Scorsese's directorial brilliance or De Niro's gripping interpretation of a Vietnam veteran named Travis Bickle slowly descending into madness. He was watching it because in his descent of the madness, he thought that he and Travis Bickle, well, you know, they...
We have a lot in common.
And one of the things they had in common was Iris, the 12-year-old prostitute played by Jodie Foster. John Hinckley began dressing like Travis Bickle, and he began to think a lot about Jodie Foster. Not her character from the movie, but the real Jodie Foster. And the more he thought about her, the more he began to think, hey, you know, we're...
made for each other?
I will let FamousTrials.com pick it up. Quote, in the spring of 1977, admitting defeat in his attempt to launch a musical career, Hinckley returned to Texas Tech, where he sporadically attended classes and spent most of his time alone. Over the next 2 years, Hinckley's parents expressed increasing concern to their son about his occupational goals, meaning get a fucking job. His depression deepened, life seemed to lack purpose. In August 1979, he bought his first gun and took it target shooting. Not very often, John. Two times that fall, he played Russian roulette. And by Christmas of 1975, fear of facing his family caused him to spend the holiday by himself in Lubbock. A photo took of himself in early 1980 shows him holding a gun to his temple. In the summer of 1980, Hinckley informed his parents that he had a new career goal, writing. He asked his parents to pay for a writing course at Yale. Hinckley never intended to enroll in the writing course. His interest in visiting New Haven centered on one of Yale's undergraduates, Jodie Foster. With $3,600 of his parents' money and promising to work diligently at Yale, Hinckley set off for Connecticut on September 17th, unquote. You know, I once asked my folks to loan me about $500 for a writing class, and my mom sent me a coupon for 10% off on an intro course at Big Ed's Truck Driving and TV VCR Repair Academy. And in hindsight, she was right. I probably should have used that coupon. John did not attend the writing class at Yale.
Big surprise there.
But he was writing prolifically. It's just that he was penning love letters to Jodie Foster. Many, many letters that he would leave in her mailbox because he was too shy to approach her in person, which I gotta say is probably way better for Jodie. But hey, he did call her on the phone a couple of times where he engaged in brief and awkward conversations with her. Quoting now from crimelibrary.com, quote, he was able to get her phone number and had two conversations with her in which she gave him a polite but firm brush off. I can't carry on these conversations with people I don't know, she told him. It's dangerous, and it's just not done, and it's not fair, and it's rude. Hinckley told her, well, I'm not dangerous. You see, Hinckley tape recorded his conversations with Foster. I promise you that. Spoiler alert! John was, in fact, quite dangerous. Going back to the text. In his confused mind, John came to believe that he knew a way to Foster's heart. He would assassinate a president, thus proving his own importance and imitating Travis Bickle, who had intended to kill a presidential candidate, unquote. Of course, John didn't head straight to Washington, D.C. to find the president. No. He had some side trips to make. More from famous trials. Quote, for the next few weeks, Hinckley continued to fly frenetically around the country. He reappeared in New Haven, then flew to Lincoln, Nebraska on October 6th, where he hoped to meet with one of the leading ideologians of the American Nazi Party.
Nothing changes. Fucking Nazis.
The hoped-for meeting never took place, and from Lincoln, it was on to Nashville for another Carter campaign stop. Security officers at the Nashville airport arrested Hinckley for carrying handguns in his suitcase and confiscated both the guns and handcuffs they found in his luggage. What legal consequence do you think John faced for flying around the country with guns, ammunition, and handcuffs in his luggage? He paid a fine and was released. After yet another short visit to Yale, Hinckley flew to Dallas, where he purchased more handguns. Then Hinckley boarded a flight for Washington, continuing his trailing of Carter. On October 20th, his $3,600 exhausted, Hinckley flew home to Colorado, where his parents expressed strong disappointment in his failure to carry out his promises about getting a job, not killing the president. After Hinckley overdosed on an antidepressant medication, the Hinckleys arranged for their son to meet with a local psychiatrist, Dr. John Hopper. Hopper met with Hinckley several times over the course of the next 4 months, but learned nothing of Hinckley's thoughts of assassination and little of his obsession with Foster. Hopper urged Joanne and Jack Hinckley to push John towards emotional and financial independence, unquote. This was the state of psychiatric medicine at the end of the 1970s. The treatment was always, don't worry about it,
he's gonna be fine.
Just, you know, give him some space and some money and tell him how great he's doing. I'm sure nothing bad will happen. I will stake my professional reputation on it. But you know what? He was wrong. John wasn't fine. In fact, he was quite off his rocker, and he was going to kill someone. So after a few months of his parents trying to get him to pull himself together, not as one would think through medical treatment in a medical institution, but more by good old-fashioned American values, by pulling himself up for the bootstraps, and of course...
Don't be crazy.
Eventually... His mom gave him some money and put him on a plane to Los Angeles, where John stayed for one day, then got on a plane for Washington, D.C. He checked into a hotel in downtown D.C. He had breakfast at McDonald's.
Hey, let's have some breakfast.
I know, we don't have time. I know, we don't have enough money.
I know.
Well, hello. McDonald's, start our morning bright. Scrambled eggs and sausage, egg McMuffin cooked up right. In times like these, it sure is nice to get so much at a McDonald's price.
I know.
Nobody can do it
at a McDonald's price
like McDonald's can.
Over his egg McMuffin, he read the morning paper, where on page A4 of the Washington Star, he saw that the Gipper would be giving a speech that very day, just a few blocks away from his hotel. So we went back to his room. He took a shower, took a Valium, loaded his .22 pistol with 6 explosive bullets that he purchased legally, because again, explosive bullets were legal in 1981, and then sat down to write a letter to Jodie Foster. A letter that I will now read to you in full.
Dear Jodie,
There is a definite possibility that I will be killed in my attempt to get Reagan. It is for this very opportunity that I'm writing you this letter now. As well you know, I love you very much. Over the past 7 months, I've left you dozens of poems, letters, and love messages in the faint hope that you could develop an interest in me. And although we talked on the phone a couple of times, I never had the nerve to simply approach you and introduce myself. Besides my shyness, I honestly did not wish to bother you with my constant presence. I know the many messages left at your door and in your mailbox were a nuisance, but I felt that it was the most painless way for me to express my love for you. I feel very good about the fact that you at least know my name and know how I feel about you. And by hanging around your dormitory, I came to realize that I'm the topic of more than a little conversation, however full of ridicule it may be. At least you know that I'll always love you. Jody, I would abandon this idea of getting Reagan in a second if I could only win your heart and live out the rest of my life with you, whether it be in total obscurity or whatever. I will admit to you that you're the reason I'm going ahead with this attempt now is because I just cannot wait any longer to impress you. I've got to do something now to make you understand in no uncertain terms that I am doing all of this for your sake. By sacrificing my freedom and possibly my life, I hope to change your mind about me. This letter is being written only an hour before I leave for the Hilton Hotel. Jody, I'm asking you to please look in your heart and at least give me the chance with this historical deed to gain your respect and love. I love you forever, John Hinckley.
As I've already explained how the shooting went down, I will now talk about the trial. You are well aware that John Hinckley Jr. was found legally insane. It's not a medical diagnosis, but a legal definition. PBS's Frontline explains the standard at the time of his trial. And I'm just going to drop in the acronyms and the words here because this is not a law podcast. This is a podcast about dick jokes. So if you want to know what ALI or McNaughton rule is, go look them up. Quote, instead of requiring a defendant to have no understanding whatsoever the nature of his acts or the difference between right and wrong, the ALI standard requires merely that he lack a substantial capacity to understand right from wrong, and expands the McNaughton rule to include an irresistible impulse component that many state courts during the 60s and 70s found reasonable and struck down laws providing for the automatic and indefinite confinement of defendants who had been acquitted by reason of insanity. The court said that due process and equal protection clause concerns require that those found not guilty but confined due to mental illness have the right to periodic reassessment of their mental health status and dangerousness. And if the evaluations did not find justifications for continued confinement, the defendants would be released, unquote. Meaning you went to jail for as long as you were crazy, and as soon as the doctor said you weren't crazy anymore, you got out. The trial of John Hinckley Jr. is almost, but not quite enough to be a standalone episode. There's a lot that I want to include, but that would make this episode run into the 45-minute to an hour range, and honestly, I know all of you don't have that kind of tolerance for my voice. So I'm going to include some plum bits and wrap it up. More from famous trials. Quote, all the government psychiatrists concluded that Hinckley was legally sane, that he appreciated the wrongfulness of his acts, which he almost certainly did, at the time of the shooting. All three defense psychiatrists, diagnosed Hinckley as psychotic and legally insane at the time of the shooting. Further evidence of the severity of Hinckley's mental problems came in May, 2 days before his 26th birthday, when he attempted suicide by overdosing on Valium. In November, he tried again, this time hanging himself in his cell window. Hinckley insisted that his lawyers get Jodie Foster to testify at his trial. If they didn't make every effort to do so, he said, he would refuse to cooperate in his own defense.
I'm not sure how John helping his own defense was actually going to help his defense.
Eventually, Fuller arranged for Foster's lawyer to have the actress testify in closed session with only the judge, the lawyers, and Hinckley present.
The tape could later be introduced into evidence at the trial. When Hinckley received the news, he excitedly told his parents, "Mom, Dad, I'll be right there in the same room." And on March 30th, 1982, authorities took Hinckley to the federal courthouse in Washington for Jodie Foster's videotape testimony. The testimony sorely disappointed Hinckley, who received not a single glance or word on his behalf from Foster. As Foster completed her testimony, Hinckley hurled a ballpoint pen at her and said, "Oh, get you, Foster!" John Hinckley Jr., the original incel. And Marshall surrounded Hinckley and hauled him from the room, unquote. After a lengthy trial, Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity and sentenced to St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington, D.C., until no longer deemed a threat to himself or others. And that, Pod Friends, is where he stayed until July of 2016, when it was out in the open that Reagan was dead and Jodie Foster was gay. I'm not saying that John Hinckley finding out that Jodie Foster was gay and had always been gay is the reason he suddenly got sane. I'm just saying it's a possibility. When he was released to the care of his mother with conditions like he had to get a job and he couldn't search for Jodie Foster on the internet. In July of 2022, he was released from all restrictions and was basically free to pursue his life as if he had never shot Ronald Reagan. Hinckley apologized to all the families of all those involved and even to Jodie Foster, who, again, he probably figured out was gay and was never going to date him in the first place. These days, John Hinckley Jr. is trying to pursue his career in music again. He released a record and naturally has a YouTube channel. Honestly, I took a listen. His music isn't bad.
I'm just a lonely dreamer. People say I'm dreaming my life away. I'm just a lonely...
I mean, John Hinckley Jr. isn't the strongest guitarist and singer, but the actual songs aren't bad. I'd buy them if someone else was singing and playing it. Sadly for John, he's had some trouble taking his music on tour because every time he tries to book a gig, it seems like the venue ends up canceling due to security concerns, which has led to John making the inevitable complaint of an aging boomer when denied something that they feel that they are entitled to. He told the New York Post, quote, "I think it's fair to say that I'm a victim of cancel culture," John Hinckley Jr. opined. "It keeps happening over and over again," unquote.
That's not how it works. That's not how any of this works.
You're not canceled, John. You shot Ronald Reagan. And honestly, the liberals, the people that do the canceling according to how boomers think cancel cultures work, love you for it, John. We love you for it. We think you did it. You think you could have done a better job? But we have no problems with you going out playing your music. You could even write songs about shooting Reagan, and we'd fucking buy them.
On Oops the Podcast, join me, comedian Giulio Gallerati, as I examine everyday life, the mistakes, the bad decisions, the goals, the jokes, the social engagements, and all things in between. I'm joined every week by producer and personal confidant Ryan Lynch, various other comedians, for witty, candid, and intoxicating conversation. Our listeners love Oops for sophisticated banter, aka your mom could listen, and many feel like they're in the room with us chopping it up with old pals. You can find every episode of the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.
Sorry, I'm so gonna get a visit from the Secret Service after this. Can you get a post-death president threat visit? Probably, because it might make them think that I'm threatening a future or a past president or a past president that might become a future one. And I'm not. There's little real difference between John Hinckley Jr. and, say, Mark David Chapman. We talked about Mark David Chapman in episode number 290.
That's a plug.
Because you see, both men had serious mental disorders. Hinckley's obsession with Jodie Foster's and Chapman's with John Lennon. And both men could have been helped if the people in their lives were paying closer, or more to the point, any at all attention at all. And if the medical system actually did something for them rather than treat them and street them. Both men had unfettered access to guns and lived in a society where no one seemed to care that these obviously disturbed men had guns. People knew they were crazy. People knew they had guns, and people just wanted them to do whatever it was they were going to do to someone else. And if all this sounds kind of familiar, I just like to point out that the exact same thing happens today, just on a larger scale with bigger guns and mostly in elementary schools. I don't know if John Hinckley Jr. knew what he was doing was wrong when he shot Reagan. I mean, I strongly suspect he did. He just had the money to hire good lawyers. But fuck, man, he shot the goddamn president. And you know what this country did? Well, I'll tell you what they didn't do. They didn't change the gun laws. Oh, God, no, 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 no. What they did was change the insanity defense laws to make it harder for crazy people to claim they were crazy when they did crazy things, but not harder for crazy people to get guns. Because America will do anything except the one thing that could actually make a difference by making it harder for people to get their hands on fucking guns. And we keep having the same tired argument about mental health whenever someone shoots up a school or a theater or wherever they're shooting up this week. And we just keep blaming all the death and blood on mental health. And it seems to me that the really crazy people are the ones who refuse to accept the reality of a broken gun culture. And no matter how many presidents get shot and how many children die, it's just going to keep on going that way. Which, when you think about it, makes them the crazy ones. But hey, at least they can still buy a gun. That is it for the show this week. Probably should have been a two-part series, but you know what? I just did a two-parter, and I got more multi-parters in the hopper, so I tried to keep it short this time around. There might be a related episode next week about all the shenanigans that went on for Reagan a shot, but honestly, probably not. I've been doing a lot of heavy shit lately, and it's time to lighten things up a bit. So, lighten up, rate and review us wherever you get your pods. Get us a dollar on patreon.com/whatthehellpodcast. We're going to use that money to buy some John Hinckley Jr. records and then do all the things Jeremy tells you to do in the closing credits. Otherwise, he's not going to approve my expense request to the network for a summer writer's workshop residency at the University of Iowa. He'll just give me a coupon for Big Ed's Truck Driving Academy and TV VCR repair. I really wish my mom would stop talking to Jeremy. And so, for me, Dave, his palms are sweaty, his knees weak, arms are heavy, there's vomit on his sweater already, mom's spaghetti. Bledsoe, producer,
he's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready to drop bombs, but he keeps forgetting. My God, you really are pretty good in your Secret Service, aren't you?
Gavin! And all the fictional Jodie Foster fans on the show, we want to say, we're not going to say anything because I don't really want to visit from the Secret Service about anyone. I mean, I'm not a threat to the president. Not the current president. Forget I said anything. We'll see you all next week.
What the Hell Were You Thinking stars Dave Bledsoe and features Gavin St. James and several fictional minions. The show is produced by Kimberly Steele and a part of the Seltzer Kings podcast network. You can find more information on the show on their website, whatthehellpodcast.com, or on Twitter at @thehell_podcast, or on Facebook as What the Hell Podcast. Thanks for listening.
I have no ending for this, so I take a small bow.
Should have aimed higher.